why did the president send out his press secretary in front of that podium to utter a provable falsehood? It's a small thing, but the first time he confronts the public, it undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office on day one.
Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. What you're saying, it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that.
Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
The Chicago event started in Grant Park. A crowd, originally this morning, the organizers told us 70 to 75,000 people expected. We are now hearing it is possible that 150,000 people are in the Grant Park area for this rally.
To those who took this oath, this is a moment that we'll never forget. It's also an opportunity to reflect on the immense responsibility we have to our president and our nation. It is our duty to serve with character and integrity and to support President Trump as he places the interests of the American people first in everything that he does.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Opening Bell. Today is Monday. It's January 23rd. It's 5:10 in the morning. Glad to have you along for another business week, another business day as well. Lots of ground to cover today. We have our CEO spotlight coming up a little later in the half hour. We'll be talking about some of the risks of the Donald Trump presidency and what the Federal Reserve might be doing ahead. But first, we begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Overnight Dow futures are lower by about 19 points. S&P and NASDAQ futures are off as well. Global markets grappling with uncertainty, too, today over the policies of President Trump and concerns that he'll pursue a protectionist agenda. Investigators paring back with some risk, buying Japanese yen, driving the dollar lower. European equities and oil also fell. Earnings from Halliburton, McDonald's, and Yahoo will come later in the day and could drive the markets just a little bit. Here's some news. Since you slept last night, if you have a business flight out of O'Hare today and anywhere in the country, really, on United, you might want to call ahead to the airline to see if you are on time, if your flight has not been canceled. United Airlines says six flights had to be canceled, more than 200 delayed last night because of a computer problem that forced a ground stop for all domestic flights that lasted about 2.5 hours. Company spokesman this morning telling us that it was an IT issue, still not being very clear on just what kind of IT issue it was. The airline waiving flight change fees through Wednesday for any travelers affected by the problem. And Chicago-based United says there'll be no extra charge for anyone flying in the same class and between the same cities. The airline and its subsidiary United Express operate more than 4,500 flights a day to 339 airports across five countries. Over the weekend, White House senior advisor Kellyanne Conway told us that President Trump will not release his tax returns. Conway was asked on the Sunday shows about a petition on the White House website signed by more than 200,000 people calling for Trump to release his returns. She told ABC's This Week yesterday the White House is not going to release tax returns. And that brings us to another developing story this morning. We have learned from the New York Times that a team of prominent constitutional scholars, Supreme Court litigators, and former White House ethic lawyers will go to court today, federal court. They'll file a lawsuit against Donald Trump saying he's violating the Constitution by allowing his hotels and other business operations to keep accepting payments from foreign governments. All of that happening today. Well, it is Monday. That means it's time for our CEO spotlight. We're very happy today to have the CEO of Pekin Singer Strauss Asset Management in Chicago, Adam Strauss, with us today. Pekin Singer Strauss is one of those private-owned asset management companies. They have a small team of people working to sort of, like, they call themselves a boutique asset, and provides custom portfolio management services, personal financial advice, very important in these rocky times on the markets. And Adam, good to have you with us today. Why don't we start by you telling us a little bit about your firm?
So the firm was started a little bit over 25 years ago. And, you know, our primary business is really that we're a financial advisor to mostly individuals and families in the Chicago area who've given us their savings and their retirement money to manage in order to meet their financial goals. And so, you know, we seek to hit that, whether it be saving for college or helping to make sure that they have a secure retirement. And then about 10 years ago, we launched a mutual fund that we manage called Appleseed Fund.
This is kind of a unique firm in that it's all of the employees own the company.
Yes, we're an independent financial advisor, so we're not owned by any large financial services company or anything like that. We own ourselves.
How does that set you apart from those other firms?
Well, we think that by being independent, it allows us to be more independent in the way that we think about things. So with all of our clients, a very important part of our culture and the very important part of the way that we work with clients is we always do what's in the best financial interests of the client. And so it allows us to put our clients into products that make sense for them rather than products that whatever company owns us wants us to sell. And that occurs with a lot of other financial services firms.
And a matter of fact, that's in the news lately because it's one of the regulations that we may see go away with the new administration. And that is this idea that you're on my side, not on somebody else's side.
That's right. I mean, since the very beginning, we've been on the side of our clients where we try to plan for our clients' futures in a way that benefits them, but also, importantly, put our clients into investments that are going to generate attractive risk-adjusted returns and that are going to help them meet their financial goals rather than benefit us or benefit some other product.
When somebody comes to you and they want you to work on their behalf, I would imagine it's a nervous time because they're obviously putting a lot of their financial future in your hands. How do you talk them off of that nervousness and get them comfortable with you going forward?
So a lot of times when we meet with a prospect or a client, we'll actually start by putting together a financial plan where we lay out their current financial situation and then help them plot out a map for the future. And that really, I think, helps clients get a little bit more comfortable about the way that you think and that the way that you might be advising them going forward. A lot of times that's a good first step in order to get clients comfortable with the idea of investing with us.
Do you have on your team people that all have all kinds of different backgrounds and experience levels and interest levels?
Oh, absolutely. For one thing, our investments are not just in the United States. They're all over the world. We have research analysts who have expertise in particular industries, but we also have expertise with different areas of the world. For example, our most recent research analyst that we hired comes from Eastern Europe, and so he has a lot of language skills and cultural understanding of some of the countries that are located in Eastern Europe.
This is also another big topic lately, is this globalization and populism. How important is the notion of doing business globally to not only big companies and corporations, but people who are investing?
It's important. It's an incredibly important question right now. Globalization has been a huge tailwind to the global economy, and especially a huge tailwind to corporate profits, because companies have been able to locate manufacturing plants overseas, reduce their costs, and that's been a significant contributor to profit margin growth. And right now, we're almost at a record level of corporate profit margins as a result. If globalization reverses, just the opposite happens. I would expect corporate profit margins to compress because they're no longer as able as they were before to relocate to the lowest cost country. The flip side of that is, if you're a worker in the United States, it might boost your wages. So, it depends on sort of what your perspective is.
This is obviously a big topic these days. What is the danger moving forward here? Are you worried about what you're seeing coming, perhaps, not only from our country, but with the UK, with Brexit and other countries that might be thinking about leaving the European Union?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, I think we live in an extremely volatile economic environment right now. Having nothing to do with politics, we're in the eighth year of an economic expansion. Right. And so if you look at U.S. history, there's no economic expansion that has lasted more than 10 years. So regardless of circumstance, we're getting closer to the end of the expansion than we are to the beginning. And then in addition, there's an enormous amount of debt out there, and I'm not just talking about the United States, and I'm not just talking about the U.S. government. It's consumer debt, it's corporate debt, it's government debt, and it's across the world. We're really at a record level right now. So if anything goes wrong, you've got a lot of debt leverage that could create a lot of problems, which is, you know, one of the things that happened during the last recession is it wasn't just a recession. It became a financial crisis because of all the mortgage debt that was out there. This time it's more corporate debt, but it's a similar problem.
And there's government debt there too, and the notion that we might be adding more to that for obvious infrastructure programs that we arguably need, that's a problem too, isn't it? If we start spending,
well, I think if we, you know, a fiscal spending program would I think boost the economy in the short run, but yes, it would make the long term debt situation more problematic than it was before.
So remind people what happens at the end of the expansion. Is it recession? Is it off the cliff completely? What could possibly, or all of the above?
I think it's a likely recession. I'm not saying that it's going to happen in 2017, but I think that, you know, sometime over the next 3 years or so, it's got to happen. And I think that it's important as an investor that you position yourself appropriately for that.
And so that was where I was going with that. As you sit down with me, for instance, as an investor, how do you plan for that? How do you not know what might happen but still plan for it?
So, you know, what we tell clients right now, and the way that we position our client portfolios right now, is we're pretty defensive, right? So we have a lower exposure to stocks than we might normally otherwise have. And U.S. stocks in particular are extremely expensive right now. So we have a lower exposure to U.S. stocks than what we might have to foreign stocks, where the price of shares is significantly lower, and where the economies in some of those countries have not been booming quite as much. And so we try to diversify clients out of those investments that are the most risky at the height of a potential economic expansion.
Is there one investor that you like to see more than another, or is it just anyone that comes with money that you like working with? Is it more, do you select folks, or do you take everybody that comes in?
You know, the kinds of investors that we work best with are people who have a long-term orientation, because that's what we have, right? So when we make an investment, we don't make an investment thinking that we're going to outperform over the next 3 months or the next 12 months even. We're looking out sometimes 5 or 10 years. And so we're looking for investors who have a similar long-term orientation. In some instances in the past, we've had new clients come on board who are really, you know, they're more speculators. They're more sort of momentum driven. They want to own what works right now. And, you know, I think that on a long term basis, that's a recipe for disaster. And we just don't take that approach.
I often hear from long term investors that we shouldn't be looking at our portfolios every day, every week, it should be a long view that has us maybe checking in on it a couple of times a year. Is that something that you do as investment advice as well?
I couldn't agree with that more. I would even say a couple times a year might be too often.
Yeah.
I would say once a year, take a look. But really, you know, what you should be doing is trying to invest in good companies at attractive prices, and then holding on for a long time.
Let's talk more about the Appleseed Fund. How did it begin, and what is it focusing on?
We launched Appleseed Fund back in 2006. And what Appleseed Fund is it's a go-anywhere value fund where we can invest basically in high-quality companies with responsible management teams that we think are significantly undervalued in any country and of any size companies. And we also apply environmental, social, and governance factors to the companies that we look at. And our first 10 years have been really good. You know, we generated a 10% return last year, which significantly exceeded that of the MSCI World Index. But much more importantly, over the last 10 years, we've outperformed our benchmark, the MSCI World Index, by about 2% a year. So it's been a good first 10 years. You know, we hope it continues over the next 10 years.
This is a question that I have sort of as investors have often asked me this who are just getting into the game, because I'm looking at the chart on Appleseed Fund, and it's going up. It goes up every year. Do we look at a chart like that, and can that tell us anything about the nuts and bolts of it, or where should we do our homework when we see a chart like this?
Well, when you're looking at a mutual fund, you want to certainly look at a fund's past performance, but you want to look at other things too. I think an important part is to really just get comfortable with the manager and the process. In some cases, you might have a great chart, but the manager just changed. And so the new manager may have a completely different strategy. And so that chart no longer matters. In our case, the same people are managing the fund today that managed the fund over the last 10 years. So that's, you know, that's not an issue. But, yeah, I would be very careful about just looking at a historical chart before choosing a particular mutual fund or a particular strategy.
Let's talk more about you as a CEO. What are your strengths that you bring to the job that helps your company and your firm succeed?
Well, you know, we're a small firm. There's 19 of us. And so, you know, I think that for any company, culture is really important, but it's particularly important for a small company culture. So, you know, we try to be very careful about who we hire so that we bring in people who are going to be good fits for our culture. And what we try to do is bring in people who, first of all, on the client services side, will absolutely bend over backwards to make sure that we're putting the clients first from an investment standpoint, but also from a services standpoint. You know, and then on the research front, I mean, we're value investors. And so there's a particular mentality related to value investing that's very rare and very hard to find. And so we end up talking to a lot of people before we ever hire somebody to our investment team because they have to be a good fit for the way that we think about the world and for the way that we think about investments.
I'm looking at the picture page from your website. It looks like you have a lot of young faces on staff. Is your team generally a young team?
We have a range of people from 20 or our 20s all the way up into the 70s. So a couple of the old guard are still with the firm. Rick Singer, who was one of the founders back in 1990, still works for the firm as a senior advisor. But the main partnership of the firm we're in our late 40s.
The reason I ask the question is because we focus a lot on millennials.
Yeah.
And are they investing? Are they learning enough about investments and getting involved in investments enough? Or is there more that they should be doing?
Well, I think that millennials, what generally occurs is that the generation that has money to invest tend to be the older generations.
Right.
So I think millennials have an interest in investing. What they don't have is capital,
yeah.
Right? But as they get older, they're going to, number one, you know, inherit capital from older generations. And number two, they're going to become more advanced in their career. And becoming more advanced in their career, they're going to increase their income and have capital invest that way. So, we think millennials are really interested, especially in the approach that we take with investing. And we expect that to become a larger and larger percentage of our business. Right now it's still pretty small.
Would you say some of the other potential threats out there to investors as we look forward maybe 1 or 2 or 3 years?
I think that the biggest threat is, I'll go back to what I said before, is this high level of debt to GDP, because what that means is that any kind of accident can create a significant economic problem. It might be a recession. It might be a war somewhere that takes place. It might be just some random bank in Europe that blows up that causes some kind of a knock-on effect that creates a much more significant problem than if the world weren't as leveraged as it is. So my big concern is really just not the debt to GDP per se, but how fragile that makes everything should anything occur. So that's, and it's hard to predict exactly what's going to, knock the economy off track.
Speaking of the future, I'd like to ask you maybe your thoughts on what, technology might do to investments. We've heard a lot about artificial intelligence and more of these apps seem to be taking over and robo-investments seem to be coming into their popularity. Are we going to be seeing more of that as we move into the future?
You know, I think we are going to be seeing more of that. I think we have to be careful about making sure that it's implemented correctly. I say this to a lot of investors. I wouldn't touch an S&P 500 index with a 10-foot pole right now because you see a huge herd of investors that are going into all of these passive instruments. And a lot of that is driven by the growth of robo-advisors. The problem is that these passive indexes are the most overvalued and the most risky at the most at the worst possible time in the market. And so, you know, I worry about the investment returns that a lot of these investors who are chasing good historical performance are going to get over the next 10 years going into some of these passive indexes.
Yeah, I think I'm right there with you. I'm not very trustworthy of algorithms just yet.
Yeah, me too.
Adam, good to meet you, and best of luck to you and your firm.
Thanks for your time, Steve.
Adam Strauss is the CEO of Peek & Singer Strauss Asset Management in Chicago in our CEO Spotlight today. You can follow them on Twitter at Peek & Singer and online. Visit them at peekandsinger.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program. At 5:39, President Trump could find that his election victory, the thrill of actually winning, may give way to the perils of governance. So says Morgan Stanley in a note to its clients yesterday. Morgan Stanley warning that lingering disagreements between Trump and GOP political leaders may have unintended policy consequences, adding that execution risks may make it difficult for Trump's policies to have their intended effect. We're seeing a little bit of that impact on Wall Street this morning as Dow futures are weak heading toward the opening bell. We're going to talk more about the economy and what might lie ahead for the Federal Reserve this year, how they're going to maybe react to some of this. Stephen Esposito is a senior vice president and wealth advisor at Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest. Stephen, welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on. Let's start first. I know we're going to talk a little bit about Janet Yellen, but let's talk a little bit about this note that went out to Morgan Stanley clients yesterday. There is the Trump rally may be fading, and there are definite risks ahead, right?
Well, yeah, the key is going forward, like anything else, how much of the president's agenda is enacted going forward. It's not as simple as it would be in the normal business world. He's got to deal with Congress. Of course, they control both houses of Congress. But we'll see what happens. Will he get his tax reform, his regulatory reform, his health care, trade negotiations, all those pro-growth strategies through quickly, or will it linger? And that's going to be the key as far as the market short term. I wouldn't focus on too much on the short term, but that seems to be dominating the market right now.
Because there is a whole long list of things. He's got a really strong agenda and lots on it. So that there are a lot of moving parts, I guess, is the best way to describe that, right?
Oh, absolutely. He wants to accomplish a lot. He decides that he wants to get this all done quickly. It may not happen as quickly as he wants, but the key is going to be whether it happens in April or happens in June, what have you. It won't really matter for the long term. It's the focus on the short term that investors need to get away from and really focus on the long term, the direction and the pro-growth policies that are designed and hopefully will get enacted.
Yeah, the long game, as it's called, I guess, is a good way to describe that. Stephen, I want to talk to you a little bit about what Federal Reserve presidents across the country and Janet Yellen have been talking about. First, the presidents, they have a couple of them had said in speeches last week, it's time to really see some details of what Donald Trump wants to do, because without those, we're just sort of flying blind. What kind of impact is all of that having on the decisions being made by the Federal Reserve?
Well, like anything else, what's going to affect the Federal Reserve is not political moves, rather it'll be actual accomplishments and what is enacted. Also, they're going to look at the economy and the growth. We started to see some nice growth in the economy right before the election. Things started to pick up a little bit, and you're starting to see some animal spirits, which people's attitude has a lot to do with what they're going to do with their money, how they're going to invest in their businesses, et cetera. So they're going to wait and see. The Federal Reserve is going to need to see growth. Need to see the numbers coming in and continuing to grow, and then they'll react accordingly. They're not going to go out there and jump the gun. They're going to take a prudent measure. But their goal right now, they said, is to raise rates three times in 2017. They thought they were going to do that in 2016, and of course they didn't. But we'll see. The talk is three-quarter point raises, and they're hoping by the end of 2019 to have Fed funds up to about 3 percentage points. That's a pretty big difference from where it is today.
We saw the Fed Reserve Chairman stand at Stanford University last week. Janet Yellen says, talking about employment, unemployment, which is down, inflation starting to tick higher. And she said that it would be risky and unwise to allow the economy to overheat by keeping interest rates low for too long. They clearly are watching the data closely, aren't they?
Absolutely, and I agree. The Federal Reserve has been carrying all the water for the economy for the last 7 years. there's been little or no fiscal stimulus in these systems. So the Fed is basically doing everything. It's kind of like having a rear-wheel drive car, and one side of the right rear wheel is spinning at 80 miles an hour, and the left wheel is doing nothing. What's going to happen? The car is going to fishtail. It's going to go in circles and really not go anywhere. If you can get the right wheel down from 80 miles an hour to a reasonable level and get the left wheel moving in synchronized with the right wheel, then the economy in the car will start to move forward. So that's what we need. And if that does occur, I think we can finally get some real traction in the economy, better than 2% growth.
And that's something that she's obviously going to be watching as the year goes along. You know, last year they promised a couple of rate increases, delivered one. This year they say maybe three. Is there a credibility issue here, or were they prudent in only doing one last year?
I would say yes and no. The problem is they anticipated better growth, and people's attitudes were simply expecting slow growth. They're more of the same, 1.5% to 2%. So people weren't overly confident when they go out there and take risk and invest. Combination of higher health care costs, higher tax rates, all those things just kept the economy back. Now there's a different attitude, and attitude makes a big difference on what investors do. So I think what they did was reasonably prudent. They were forced to keep rates lower than they really wanted to, because the economy simply wasn't getting going. But now that you actually do get fiscal stimulus like tax cuts, et cetera, then, and that actually can act and start to filter through the economy, the Fed can then now take the foot off the pedal, so to speak, and ease back and let rates gradually go up. But I think being prudent is very important. You don't want to jerk the economy around and have these wild swings in the economy if you don't have to, and thereby the financial market. So they were forced in many ways to do what they had to do. Simply, they weren't getting help up Washington.
We, on the opening bell, like to not only have a conversation about stuff that's important to investors and business community, we try to bring in people who may not know a lot of these terms and know what the Federal Reserve does, know a lot about the economy. And so the next question is kind of for them, and that is, you know, we saw the Beige Book come out last week, and we saw minutes come out earlier this month. Why is it important to see the Beige Book? What is it? And those minutes, what do they tell us?
The Beige Book is an idea of what the Federal Reserve is looking at. It's basically a summary of the regional economic conditions containing reports from each of the 12 regions all over the country. And it gives an idea of what the Fed is looking at when they make their decisions. It gives us an idea of what is going on in the economy. The good news is the overall report was relatively upbeat. They're starting to see some real traction. Not a lot, but the light at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully it's not a train right now. And that's what they're looking at. So if they continue to get more stimulus and more upbeat activity out of Washington and the economy, then their confidence will grow. The results will come in affirming that, allowing them to raise interest rates. So it's important to look at the Beige Book to get an idea of what may or may not happen going forward.
Stephen, every time Janet Yellen's on, or we quote her saying that the economy may be at full employment, my Twitter feed goes crazy, and I get lots of emails from people saying, hey, wait a second, that's not really accurate. There are a lot of people out there that still don't have jobs. How do you answer those questions?
That's true. Numbers are numbers, and you have to look at them behind what is there, so to speak. And if you look going forward, where these numbers really are, there's a lot of underemployment. There's a lot of people who have a lower paying job. They're not seeing the wage hikes they really wanted. So when you say 5% unemployment, it's all relative. A large segment of the population is no longer being counted because they stopped looking for work. There's over 90 million people unemployed. Now, many of that is retirees, et cetera, but you don't see that type of an attitude from the average consumer that things are good and their jobs are great and they're getting nice raises, or they're in a job that they're making good livings. So that's really the issue. So your Twitter feed will go off for that reason, because numbers and statistics can be misleading, and they are right now.
Well, let's close out by having a little snapshot here of the markets. So we saw the Dow and S&P start to tick a little bit lower after trending generally higher week after week after the election. Is the Donald Trump bump over?
I don't know. We'll see. You know, if there's the talk, and then we'll see what there's action. We'll see what goes on. Remember that investors in general were positioned last year for 1% to 2% growth, continued high interest rates, and very defensive. Now, a lot of them got caught off guard. Many money managers were on the wrong side of this market. So the performance numbers were greatly below what they should have been at the end of the year in all the indices. A lot of investors suffered as a result. Now they're seeing this market start to move away from them, and they're afraid. They don't know what to do.
And how long? Stephen, how long are you giving the Trump administration to see some action here? What would be a good time frame?
I think let's see the next, the first 100 days. Let's see what gets done. I don't think it's necessarily the administration. I think it's Congress. No. We know what the administration wants to do. It was up to them to be done today, all of it. But you have to look at what Congress allows them to do. And logic would dictate, because they control both houses of Congress, that most of this, if not all of it, should get through. The question is, the bureaucracy of Washington is not the same as business. So I wouldn't really worry about whether it's done on the first week, the second week. Let's see where it is in 100 days. Let's wait for April, May, et cetera, where we're at there, and see what's accomplished and how many roadblocks he sees from his own party. That, I think, will be the key as far as confidence is concerned. And if he gets a lot of it done quickly, and, for example, tax reform is put into place and it's retroactive to January 1st, you could see a pretty nice bounce in the market.
Stephen Esposito, Senior Vice President, Wealth Advisor at Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest. Stephen, good of you to be with us on the Opening Bell.
Well, thank you for having me.
You're listening to the Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning, Dow futures are off 11 points. S&P and NASDAQ futures are lower as well. Crude oil's off just about 1.5% this morning at 52.54. Let's get the latest on agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. We ended last week, the four-day holiday shortened trading week, with live cattle futures ending a four-day winning streak at the Mercantile Exchange. The nearby cattle contract down 77 cents a hundredweight. And the hog market also was hit by some profit-taking and the weakness in the cattle market, so we saw February hogs down 12 cents of a pound. The corn futures touched a six-month high last Friday. Strong export demand and also demand from ethanol producers. Wheat followed corn higher, largely a technical trade, and profit-taking hit the soybean market. In response to an email question, the top producing states in the various commodities last year, 2016, of course, and record year in corn and soybean production. Looking at corn first, production of corn last year up 11% over the previous year. Iowa, the number one corn state, followed by Illinois, number two, and Nebraska, number three. Record year for soybean production, with a gain of 10% over the previous year. And Illinois, the top soybean producing state, followed by Iowa, and then in third place, Minnesota. Not a record year for wheat production, but it was still up 12% from 2015. Kansas is the number one wheat state, followed by North Dakota and Montana. I hope that answers your question, and you all have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
And thanks, Orion. You have a good day as well. And now the Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Monday, January 23rd, 2017. Earnings, big earnings day. It's a big earnings week, as a matter of fact. Oak Brook-based McDonald's, soon to be Chicago-based McDonald's, will report its earnings. Halliburton is also in there, Yahoo. It's a busy week, as I said, for earnings. A bunch of big companies, AT&T, Alphabet, Microsoft, Starbucks, Chicago-based Boeing, Ford, and Samsung all report earnings this week. By the way, 34 S&P 500 companies are scheduled to report this week. Of the 54 that have already reported, 74 have beat earnings estimates. This is also the beginning of tax season, the IRS opening up the doors for the 2017 tax season. Individuals can begin filing their 2016 income tax returns. Glassdoor identifies the 25 best jobs in America for 2016. The jobs that make the list have the highest overall Glassdoor job score, determined by a number of key factors: job security, job opening, salary, and career opportunities. Also today, the national emergency extension. The U.S. extends national emergency with respect to foreign terrorists who threaten to disrupt the Middle East peace process. And also later on, the Golden Raspberry nominations come out ahead of the Oscars tomorrow. 37 Golden Raspberry Awards, the Razzies as they're called, nominations will be announced today, recognizing the worst movies and performances of the year.